And welcome to the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz on this Thursday, February 16th. I want to ask you to have a pencil, pen, or your screen nearby so that you can take notes and figure out names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, any information you need to know to take action, because without your action, the reaction is going to be pretty bad. Let's start off with some news. Oregon's Elliott State Forest is to be sold. In an incredibly disappointing development, the Oregon State Land Board voted 2-1 to proceed with a plan to privatize the 83,000-acre Elliott State Forest in the Oregon Coast Range. Newly elected Democratic Treasurer Tobias Reed and Republican Secretary of State Dennis Richardson endorsed the plan to sell off the stately public forest to the timber industry, which will result in more clear cuts, muddy rivers, and locked gates for Oregonians. Governor Kate Brown made a valiant effort to oppose the privatization by offering up her own plan to keep the forest public. This horrendous deal isn't inked yet, and we are going to stop it with your help. At the hearing, Cascadia Wildlands testified against the privatization and in support of Governor Kate Brown's plan to keep the Elliott public. With our potent coalition, we will organize to advance a plan to keep the Elliott public as directed by the governor at the meeting, and we anticipate it being taken up at the April Oregon Land Board meeting. Notably, we are also awaiting a ruling on our lawsuit, Cascadia Wildlands et al. Versus Oregon Department of State Lands, that challenges the State Land Board's disposal of a 780-acre parcel from the Elliott State Forest in 2014. Oregon Revised Statute 530.450 withdraws the sale from the majority Elliott State Forest, and our case is currently in front of the Oregon Court of Appeals with a decision expected soon. The outcome has a major bearing on the larger Elliott State Forest disposal plans. Thank you for continuing to stand with us as we work overtime to confront this horrible deal. And for more information, go to the Cascadia Wildlands website, www.cascwild.org. That's cascwild.org. And from Ireland, officers believe activist was beaten to death with a tree branch over one of his campaigns in this story from Tom Brady of the Irish Independent. Gardaí, and you should know that that means policeman in Ireland, now believe that murdered environmental activist Michael McCoy was beaten to death with a tree branch. Mr. McCoy, 63, was savagely assaulted as he walked his two dogs through the woods in a Dublin mountains last September. Investigating officers are satisfied that his death was linked to one of the environmental campaigns he had carried out. A postmortem examination confirmed that he died from blunt force trauma as a result of receiving several heavy blows. A leading member of the Dublin Mountains Conservation Group, Mr. McCoy's body was found by a search team on a forest track in Ballinas Corey Hill near Britis at around 4 a.m. on Friday, September 30th, 2016. One of his dogs had stayed with him until his body was found. Mr. McCoy had lodged a large number of objections to building developments and regularly distributed leaflets highlighting his campaigns. His nephew, Shoni McCoy, told his funeral mass that his uncle loved the outdoors and he had climbed mountains across Ireland with family members. He told the mourners, "Michael lived a principled life with a strong sense of right and wrong, and he cared enough about issues to take a stand." Mr. McCoy had enrolled in university as a mature student and completed a degree in Irish studies last June. His brother-in-law, Daniel Kelly, said a senior Trinity College tutor had stated that on the roll call of the alumni of his college, Mr. McCoy's name would shine out. Officers arrested a 40-year-old suspect the day after Mr. McCoy's body was found, and he was held for questioning at the Tallaght Garda Station under the Criminal Justice Act 1984. The suspect was subsequently released without charge. He was later rearrested for further questioning, but was again let go from custody. A second suspect, aged 36, was also held for questioning following Garda inquiries. A file is being compiled by Garda for the Director of Public Prosecutions, who will determine if a prosecution should be brought against the subjects. And here's our Operation Nemesis campaign update from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. After 75 days at sea, our ships are still in the waters around Antarctica, chasing the Japanese whaling fleet. This is the first year that Sea Shepherd has returned to protect whales from the Japanese poachers since their new and revised research program was started in the 2015-2016 season, when they killed 333 minke whales, more than half of them pregnant females. The Japanese government seems unconcerned by the opinion of the rest of the world, and despite tough words from the international community, nothing has been done to put a stop to this research whaling charade. This year, the Japanese whalers set out with the same quota, but conditions are not in their favor. Seas are rougher than in previous years, and Sea Shepherd ships have kept them on the move most of the time. Despite the difficulties posed by the whalers' new plan and the weather, the Steve Irwin's helicopter was able to find the Nishin Maru factory ship. We have found the Nishin Maru red-handed killing whales, and therefore we could show the world that the Japanese government does whatever they want, despite the ruling of the International Court of Justice and despite the Australian Federal Court, says Captain Wayanda Lublink of the Steve Irwin. Unfortunately, the Ocean Warrior was searching in another area at the time, but it doesn't mean the Japanese fleet has been able to hunt without Sea Shepherd's interference. Since we found the whaling fleet, we have managed to keep them on the run, and because of the pressure from both the Ocean Warrior and the Steve Irwin, the opportunities for them to kill whales have been kept to a minimum. As it stands now, of the three harpoon ships, one has been following the Steve Irwin for weeks, thus no longer able to kill whales, and at least one other is dedicated to finding the Ocean Warrior. But in the few times we did run into this harpoon ship, the Ocean Warrior simply picked up speed and outran the vessel, shadowing us. This has put the whalers in a tough position. If they don't know where our new fast interceptor ship is, they have to constantly worry about it finding the Nishin Maru. The new Rep A whaling scheme the Japanese fleet adopted in 2015 is no more scientific than previous years. It was designed to make chasing and shutting down the fleet more difficult, which it has, says Captain Adam Meyerson of the Ocean Warrior. But the whalers' new motto of running rather than fighting may have backfired on them, as they have expended all their energy fleeing instead of whaling. We are constantly making them burn their fuel reserves and preventing at least two of the three harpoon vessels from whaling at all times. The third harpoon ship can only stop to whale if the conditions are good and if the whalers believe they are too far away to catch them in the act. Considering the weather and the constant movement of our ships, we believe that the results of this year's slaughter and their kill quota will prove to be significantly lower than last year. Obviously, every whale killed is one too many. There is still time, so our captains and crew continue to search for the Nishin Maru, and when they do find that floating slaughterhouse, we will make sure their season has ended. Sea Shepherd continues to be the only organization that takes the fight to the whalers, and the crew of the Ocean Warrior are proud to play our part in making whaling in Antarctica difficult for the outlaw whalers from Japan, said Captain Meyerson of the Ocean Warrior. And you can find out more information about the Operation Nemesis campaign at the www.seashepherd.org.au site. That's www.seashepherd.org.au. And abandoned uranium mines from the Navajo Nation will be cleaned in this story from the Environment News Service. In one of the last actions of Obama administration's Justice Department, the United States and the Navajo Nation entered into a settlement agreement with two affiliated subsidiaries of Freeport-McMoRan Incorporated for the cleanup of 94 abandoned uranium mines on Navajo land. Under the settlement, valued at over $600 million, Cypress Amax Minerals Company and Western Nuclear Incorporated will perform the work, and the United States will contribute about half the costs. The settlement terms are outlined in a proposal consent decree filed January 17th in federal court in Phoenix, Arizona. With this settlement, funds are now committed to begin the cleanup process at over 200 abandoned uranium mines on the Navajo Nation. The work to be conducted is subject to oversight of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, if it still exists, and in collaboration with the Navajo Nation Environmental Protection Agency. This remarkable settlement will result in significant environmental restoration on Navajo lands and will help to build a healthier future for the Navajo people, said Assistant Attorney General John Cruden for the Justice Department's Environment and Natural Resources Division. We appreciate the extraordinary commitment by Freeport's affiliated subsidiaries to clean up 94 mines and to achieve this settlement without litigation. This historic settlement will clean up almost 20% of the abandoned mines on the Navajo Nation, said Acting Regional Administrator Alexis Strauss for the EPA Pacific Southwest. Cleaning up the uranium contamination continues to be a top environmental priority for our regional office. The Navajo Nation encompasses more than 27,000 square miles in Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona in the Four Corners area. The geology of the region makes the Navajo Nation rich in uranium, a radioactive ore in high demand after the development of atomic power and weapons at the close of World War II. Many private entities mined more than 30 million tons of uranium ore on or near the Navajo Nation between 1944 and 1986. The United States government, through the Atomic Energy Commission, was the sole purchaser of uranium until 1966, when commercial sales of uranium began. The AEC continued to purchase ore until 1970, the last uranium mine on the Navajo Nation shut down in 1986. Many Navajo people worked in and near the mines, often living and raising families in close proximity to the mines and the mills where the ore was processed. Kidney damage has been seen in humans and animals after inhaling or ingesting uranium compounds, according to the Federal Agency for Toxic Substances. Since 2008, federal agencies including EPA, the Department of Energy, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Department of the Interior, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the Indian Health Service have collaborated to address uranium contamination on the Navajo Nation. The federal government has invested more than $130 million to address the legacy of abandoned uranium mines on Navajo lands. The Environmental Protection Agency has compiled a list of 46 priority mines for cleanup and performed stabilization or cleanup work at 9 of those mines. The EPA's cleanup efforts have generated over 100 jobs for Navajo citizens and work for several Navajo-owned businesses. The settlement includes 10 priority mines and is expected to create many jobs for Navajo workers. The settlement agreement resolves the claims of the United States on behalf of the Environmental Protection Agency against Cypress AMAX and Western Nuclear, of the Navajo Nation against the United States, and against Cypress AMAX and Western Nuclear, of Cypress AMAX and Western Nuclear against the United States. Strange sentence. Cypress AMAX and Western Nuclear agreed to perform removal site evaluations, engineering evaluations, and cost analyses, and cleanups at the 94 mines. In return for that commitment, the United States, on behalf of the Department of Interior and the Department of Energy, agreed to place $335 million into a trust account to help fund the cleanup. And wild bison return to Canada's oldest national park after more than a century in this story by Dominique Mossbergen of the Huffington Post, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Humans had hunted the animal almost to extinction, and they had not been seen in the Banff National Park area since before it was established in 1885. Now they've made a comeback, Parks Canada announced Monday. Video captured the historic homecoming. Helicopters held aloft shipping containers to lower them into a remote valley in Banff on February 1st. The doors were opened and 16 bison thundered out, running fast through the snow. This is a great day for Banff National Park. It's a great day for Canada. And frankly, it's a great day for wildlife conservation in the history of North America, Canadian conservationist Harvey Locke told the Canadian Broadcasting Company. Parks Canada said the reintroduction of wild bison to Banff was meticulously planned. Authorities first selected the animals, most of them pregnant two-year-olds, at Canada's Elk Island National Park. They then quarantined the bison and screened them for disease. In late January, the bison were loaded into shipping containers modified specifically to accommodate the animals. They were first transported by truck to a ranch near Banff before helicopters hoisted them into an enclosed pasture in the park itself. The bison will be kept in the pasture for 16 months and will be closely monitored, Parks Canada said. The animals are expected to be released to roam freely in the park in the summer of 2018. The reintroduction effort was part of a five-year-old pilot project to restore wild bison in Banff. Parks Canada called the project a historical and cultural triumph. The restoration of bison to Banff will return a keystone species to the landscape, foster cultural reconnection, inspire discovery, and provide stewardship and learning opportunities, the agency said on its website. In the long term, by reestablishing a new wild population within its historical range in Banff National Park, this will be a key contribution to national and international bison conservation efforts. The American bison, North America's largest mammal, had once been abundant across the continent. Just 200 years ago, there were an estimated 30 to 60 million of them in the wild from Mexico to northern Canada. But hunting in the 19th century drove the animal to the precipice of extinction. In Canada, the Plains bison, one of two American bison subspecies, became extinct in the wild in the 1880s. The other subspecies, the wood bison, came dangerously close to also being wiped out. The extinction crisis prompted the Canadian government, together with ranchers and conservationists, to implement various measures in an attempt to save the country's wild bison. They introduced protective regulations, including enacting hunting restrictions and establishing reintroduction programs like the recent Banff effort. In 1906, a Montana rancher named Michael Pablo sold his sizable Plains bison herd to the Canadian government. The following year, his 400 or so bison were transported by rail to the newly established Elk Island National Park. Most of the Plains bison in Canada today are descendants of Pablo's herd. Canada is now home to about 2,200 Plains bison. The Banff animals are Plains bison, and about 11,000 wood bison in the wild, according to the Wildlife Conservation Society. These numbers do not include domestic or commercial herds, which have far larger numbers. Both subspecies are still considered threatened in the wild in Canada. One of their greatest threats is insufficient population size to sustain long-term genetic integrity, the Wildlife Conservation Society said. Loss of habitat and disease are also areas of concern. And you can find more information at the Earth First Journal Newswire. And from England, a fox has been saved from the Curé and Langibbe hunt in this story from the Bristol Hunt Saboteurs, as found on the Earth First Newswire. February 5th, we paid an overdue visit to the Curé and Langibbe hunt with our friends from South Wales Hunt Saboteurs and Bath Hunt Saboteurs. We arrived late at the meet, but it turned out to be a blessing in disguise, as the hunt had left and thought their murderous activities would go undetected. Sadly for them, we were soon close on their tails. We worked relentlessly to keep the hunt in our sights. The first half of the day saw the huntsman on foot attempting to work his hounds through thick coverts, with us making sure he didn't get up to any mischief. Despite the fact that they would maintain that they were simply trail hunting, trails cannot effectively be laid through thick covert. And whilst they were following trails and we were following them, a helicopter was following us, as the hunt felt it needed protecting, and at the taxpayers' expense, no less, for the pricely sum of more than £1,000 an hour to be in the air. After managing to keep close to the hunt, we soon watched as they started pushing their hounds through a large area of woodland. The terrier men were close to keeping an eye on us, but also waiting in case a fox was to break. Sure enough, within a few minutes, a fox shot out from the covert, and the hounds soon had caught its scent. With our hearts in our throats, we managed to get in a great position. The fox sped straight past us, and we were able to rate the hounds back to the huntsman and cover the fox's trail with citronella spray. We therefore gave the fox valuable time to get away to safety. In all the years that our group has been sabbing, we have never come this close to seeing a kill firsthand. As a result of us spoiling their bloody fun, the terrier men tried throwing their weight around, but we stood our ground and pushed back in pursuit of the hunt. For the rest of the afternoon, we continued to intervene and kept the hounds from effectively hunting foxes. The stubborn hunt stayed out way past their bedtime, but we were there every step of the way. But we were very much relieved when they finally packed up their exhausted hounds. And you can find that story at the Earth First Journal Newswire. And news from the Philippines, 21 mining firms have been shut down. In this story by James Constantin of the Philadelphia Star, as found on the Earth First Newswire. 21 mining firms, including four controversial miners operating in Zambales Province in the Philippines, were ordered closed by the Department of Environment and Natural Resources for continued violation of environmental laws. Environmental Secretary Regina Paz Gina Lopez on Thursday said the firms were found to have been operating within functional watersheds, severely affecting host communities. She threatened to close seven other firms. "We have decided to close any kind of mining operation in functional watersheds. The DENR has rightfully decided to take on social justice. I am not against mining, but I am against suffering," Lopez said in a news conference in Quezon City. The country's largest mining lobby, the Chamber of Mines of the Philippines, decried the DENR decision. Mining companies were invited by government to invest in the Philippines and sign contracts with them as partners in mineral resource development. By entering into these contracts, government is bound to observe due process. Secretary Lopez cannot just shut down mines without due process, Artemio Decini, chairman of the Chamber of Mines, said. The chamber questioned the way in which the DENR mine audit, the basis of the closures and suspensions, was conducted, pointing to the inclusion of anti-mining activists that it claimed had tainted the process. Majority of the firms suspended or recommended closed were nickel operations, representing 50% of the total nickel production of the country. Lopez, who conducted aerial inspections of the mining operations, declined to reveal how she came up with the decision. When asked by members of the media for a copy of recommendations by the DENR Review Committee, "I am in no obligation to let you know what's happening here." Mines and Geosciences Bureau took 6 months to review the audit. "Mines and Geosciences Bureau has been really, really slow, and I'm not happy with them at all," she said. Lopez said the mining companies have 15 days to appeal the DNR order, which will be elevated to the Office of the President for final approval. They can accept the closure and just help DNR with ecotourism, or they can appeal, but that appeal goes to the president. The closure becomes final when the president says so, Lopez said. Officials of Oceanic Gold said their firm's suspension was unjustified, nor has any basis in law. Mining and processing activities continued at the Didipio mine in Casibu, Nuevo Vizcaya, the firm said. "We have not received any show cause notice from the DENR, nor have we received a suspension order. Should we ultimately receive a suspension order as suggested today, we have very strong legal grounds to have it overturned," Mick Wilkes, Oceana Gold president and chief executive officer, said. Likewise, listed miners included in the suspension and closure orders said they had yet to receive formal communications from the DENR. Mac Ventures Mining, ordered to shut down for operating in a watershed, emphasized that the law recognized its prior legal right to operate in the area. Global Ferro Nickel Holdings Incorporated said it had yet to be notified or investigated by the DENR for any violation of environmental laws. A subsidiary, Platinum Group Metals Corp., was one of the firms ordered closed by the DENR. And more information can be found on the Earth First Newswire. And communities demonstrate against mining in the Colombian Massif. In this story from Radio La W, translated by the Earth First Journal and found on the Earth First Newswire. Peasant and indigenous communities continue to battle against legal and illegal mining, which are damaging the Colombian Massif, a group of Andean mountains containing 362 high mountain bodies of water, 13 páramos, and other ecosystems rich in flora and fauna. So they organized a massive demonstration to reject those activities in the rural zone of La Vega to the south of Cuaca. A rural leader, Oscar Salazar, explained to La W that they had been conducting marches for life and for water, defending the Colombian Massif and the high riverbeds of the Patia, in hopes of making the community sensitive to the grave situation which mining in the area represents. This recent activity had over 300 people participating, in which they rejected the Dominical mega project, which, according to the community members, is attempting to use 26,000 hectares over 100 square miles for mining. At the same time, they oppose the legalization of the mining production units, which they consider to be a way to open the door for multinational corporations into their land. The people marched between two focal points to assure that the legalization of mining by the government will violate the fundamental rights of indigenous and peasant folks, their economy, harmony, not to mention the effect on the natural resources. And a rare forest carnivore has belatedly come onto the track for protection. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considered protecting the Northern Rockies fishers. Cat-like members of the weasel family clinging to survival in northern Idaho and Montana under the Endangered Species Act. Now the agency, whose decision is due September 30th, is seeking public comment to make the call. The trapping of wolves, bobcats, and other species has been on the rise in Idaho and Montana, and fishers caught by accident have suffered. The center petitioned to protect them in 2013, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is now more than 2 years late in making its determination. And a lawsuit has been launched to save endangered fish from gold mining. The Center for Biological Diversity and their allies have filed notice of intent to sue the state of Washington for allowing highly destructive suction dredge mining, a recreational gold mining technique, in waterways crucial to endangered salmon and steelhead trout. The suction dredge mining uses large gas-powered vacuums to suck up gravel from the bottom of rivers and streams in search of gold flakes, targeting gravel beds critical to salmon reproduction. It pollutes waterways with toxic mercury, clouds streams with sediment, kills endangered fish, and destroys cultural resources. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And you can listen to a rebroadcast on Free Radio tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. In North Adams, Massachusetts, listen to WNMB 107.1 on Friday at 5:30 in the morning. Or in Moscow, Idaho, listen to KRFP 90.3 FM Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Dade City, Florida, listen to WLSL 92.7 FM Sundays at noon. The Grateful Dread Public Radio can be found online. GDPRNashville.org, that's GDPRNashville.org, and they rebroadcast the Earth First Update Sundays at 2 a.m. And you can listen to Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1, they broadcast us sometimes, or you can always tune in somewhere out in the Central Valley of California. I'm sorry, I haven't found that note yet. And RadioForAll.net, where you can listen online or download this or any previous version of the Earth First Update. That's Radio4All.net. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and air. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening. And please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.